Stitcher Premium is having a special sale for Labor Day. For a few days only, get your first 3 months of premium for just a dollar. It's a perfect time to catch up on some fan favorites available only on premium. Here's shows like Big Grande's Teacher's Lounge, The Mysterious Secrets of Uncle Bertie's Botanarium, or all of the Comedy Bang Bang Live episodes. Just go to StitcherPremium.com/Labor Day to get your first 3 months for just a dollar. That's StitcherPremium.com/Labor Day. No promo code needed. Welcome to the Cracked Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Tom Ryman.
And we're the self-proclaimed cracked movie experts.
I think we've moved past self-proclaimed. Like,
We're doing our due diligence.
We earned this.
Yes.
We wrestled this title from other would-be experts.
After 2 months of the show, we earned it.
That, like, crushed and destroyed behind us.
Okay. Well, we'll never speak of this again. So we're here to point out some behind-the-scenes details about your favorite classics and drop some observations that may ruin or ingratiate this film for you, whatever. For the next hour, we'll be discussing and dissecting the following films: The Dark Knight Trilogy, directed by Christopher Nolan. And that's 2005's Batman Begins, 2008's The Dark Knight, and 2012's The Dark Knight Rises. All in one glorious episode, baby.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot.
Yeah, before we begin, we want to tell you about our next month's live podcast that we're doing here in L.A. It's the Cracked Movie Club will be taking over at L.A.'s UCB Sunset Theater in lieu of the normal Cracked Live podcast on Saturday, September 9th at 7 p.m., where we'll be talking about Catherine Bigelow's Point Break. We'll talk more about this at the end of the podcast, and look in the description of this episode for more details if you want to buy some tickets. Along with us today is our guest, Bridget Greenberg, who is the associate producer of video here at Cracked.
It's me.
Hey.
It is you.
Hey.
It's who I wake up and see in the mirror every morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Have that moment of daily effort. That's who that is. Hey, you.
This is identity.
Right.
Got it.
All right.
Before we dive in, Bridget, we like on the show to start off with you giving a short synopsis of, in this case, you got to...
A whole lot of movies.
A whole lot of movies this time, but please give us like a short synopsis as you remember.
Well, we start off in humble beginnings with Batman Begins, where we see a tiny little Bruce Wayne, and he watches his parents get murdered.
Do not recommend.
No, it really messes this poor kid up, and he just becomes a wayward Bruce and decides to, run away, try to get in the mind of a criminal. Which ultimately leads him to joining a mercenary group called the League of Shadows, who want to stomp out evil at all cost. And he soon finds out all cost means taking down his home city of Gotham. He rebels against them. He fights Scarecrow and some Liam Neesons and
Ra's al Ghul.
And he wins.
And he does it. He's a Batman.
A couple. They're all dressed the same.
And that takes us up to Batman Begins.
And that takes up to Batman.
Dark Knight.
Which is a year after Begins. We get a new DA in Gotham, Harvey Dent, who is cleaning up the city until the Joker arrives. Mm. And he just wants to cause chaos. He wants to get Batman and Harvey Dent to turn on their values of being good guys, I guess. Yeah. He watched a couple makeup tutorials, got himself a custom suit, and then tried to take down the Batman.
Yeah.
Which he does a pretty good job of. There are a couple fights until Joker's in jail, tells Batman he's kidnapped both his childhood love and her fiancé, Harvey Dent, and he has to save one. Saves the wrong one. Kills his love, Rachel Dawes, and turns Harvey Dent into Two-Face, who then gets murdered. He dead. And Batman decides to take the fall for Harvey Dent, not telling Gotham that their hero turned into a crazy murderer. Mm. Or a crazy person who wanted to murder. He didn't really do...
He killed a few people.
But Batman decides to take the fall, say, "No, what? I murdered Dent. He didn't turn into this crazy dude. Dent's on me. The people of Gotham need to see this guy. He's... the hero this city needs."
He made a dent in crime.
But anyway, Dark Knight Rises, the third installment. Dark Knight Rises happens about 8 years later. Gotham is at peace, and Bruce Wayne has turned into a recluse, sitting in a freshly built but also somehow still haunted Wayne Manor. But yeah, Gotham's at a time of peace until Bane comes on the scene. This dude who is promising to tear Gotham down, get rid of the 1%, and rise the proletariat of Gotham.
Yeah.
Bruce Wayne doesn't trust this guy. And neither does Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing John Blake. And eventually, our favorite hero, Catwoman, turns on Bane as well, too. And the three team up, along with the city's orphans, to take down Bane, who is going to nuke the city after he gives everybody all the money. Yeah. Batman, Robin, and Catwoman stop him. Mm-hmm. And then Bruce Wayne is set free from his Batman chains by the end of the movie. Realizes maybe he doesn't need to be Batman.
Yeah.
Maybe the Batman was in us all along.
Yeah, maybe the city of Gotham is its own Batman now.
I don't know about that one.
No, I think it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt's going to be Batman.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, but like Bruce Wayne doesn't need to be Batman.
That's true. That's true. He's finally.
And that was kind of like the where we're trying to get.
He hangs up the what is it?
The cowl.
The cape and cowl.
The cape and cowl. Yeah, that's cowl. The one line I was looking for.
He hangs up the ears.
Well, that was a very good sum up, my friend.
Thank you. Those movies are difficult to sum up.
They are because there's a lot happening and there's a lot of jumping around as we'll dive in.
Pretty typical of Nolan.
Yeah. Pretty tips Nolan. on this show, we like to compare your plot description with a few of our own rudimentary summaries that are frankly awful. Join us in this segment we call Terrible Loglines.
Jim Gordon trades his entire family for a Batman statue.
Boy develops psychosis in childhood, and much to the chagrin of psychiatrist, chooses to double down on it for the remainder of his days.
Liam Neeson teaches Bruce Wayne how to do a Taken.
The two most famous people in Gotham City disappear forever at the exact same time, and nobody suspects a thing.
Controversial. Method acting. Worth it?
A man heroically vows never to kill his enemies, then later kills his mentor's daughter, and a mentally ill public official.
A ninja-based order known for rooting out rich people's evil and injustice for thousands of years is beaten by a 1%er.
How many murders would a Batman do if a Batman promised no murders? A lot.
He does kill a lot of people.
He kills a lot of people. Yeah.
A woman successfully usurps the identity of Rachel Dawes, Bruce Wayne's lifelong friend and love interest. He does not notice.
Because the actress changed.
Yeah, it's the actress. This is terrible long lines, Tom.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to be right.
They're not good long lines.
All right, now that you guys know the plot, let's dive into the making of the movie from a pre-production to post-production standpoint. Mm-hmm. In a segment we like to call Expensive Pretending.
It's what my job is here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. She's our producer. She knows.
That's true.
Yeah.
It is.
So let's take it from pre-production. Tom, you had some thoughts on scripting.
It's probably going to be slightly more expensive than our pretending. Correct. Our humble pretending.
I mean, after like reading into it, I'm like, oh, I'm glad.
Ooh, I love that description.
I'll stick to these budgets.
I love that description of correct. Humble pretending.
Humble pretending.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to kind of do like a greatest hits thing for all three of these movies.
Yeah.
Since we're covering three, there's going to be a lot of stuff to talk about. But yeah. So, Warner Brothers have been talking for a while about rebooting. For a while, it was going to be Darren Aronofsky was going to do Batman Year One. Paul Verhoeven was attached at one point. Oh. Either one would have been crazy-ass movies.
Yeah.
Darren Aronofsky's Batman's dark, but a Darren Aronofsky Batman.
Yeah.
Would have just been Darren Aronofsky adapting a Frank Miller Batman story would have just been like,
Yeah.
And then after that, they were talking about doing a Batman versus Superman.
Oh, that sounds like a good idea.
Well, at the time, the heavy rumor was going to be like Jude Law and Christian Bale. And I think that's when Christian Bale's name first came up as a possible choice for Batman.
Jude Law is Superman.
Mm-hmm. This is in early 2000s.
I mean, I haven't looked into this, so this is just how I scale Jude Law from my TV screen.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be a very short man to play Superman. he's like 5'7", I would guess. I don't know. This is just to scale. That's a short Superman.
He's definitely shorter than Tom Hanks.
Is he?
I think so. in Road to Perdition, he appears to be shorter than Tom Hanks.
He's 5'10".
5'10". Okay, so he's a little guy.
Yeah.
He's a little guy.
Superman. That's not little.
It's
not little, but like Superman's at least 6 feet.
Superman's not 5'10".
Yeah, Superman needs to be like 6'2".
He's definitely over 6'. Yeah.
I should not be taller than Superman. That should be your yardstick.
I don't know. You should be proud of yourself.
I frequently describe myself as being Superman height.
Yeah. I like
various
that.
Profiles.
I know what that means.
I like that.
Instantly have a picture.
I get it. Yeah.
So Nolan just made Insomnia.
Right. He made Insomnia for Warner Brothers, so when he heard that Warner Brothers was looking to do a Batman reboot, he approached them with his ideas, and he said that's where he pitched them. He wanted to do, like, a realistic Batman, like a Batman that was grounded in reality.
Changing superhero movies forever.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't have the gritty reboot. Yeah, where they try to base it in reality. I think Nolan's movies, I think, are the most successful ones to do to this date.
Yeah.
In a way, he kind of ruined it for the rest of it.
Sort of.
He did it great, but...
Yeah, no, he did it super well.
Yeah, I think he did a great thing, and then everyone else just tried to mock it.
Yeah.
Some people... Marvel, I don't think, tries to do that.
No, Marvel... Yeah.
Marvel movies are very much fantasy.
But it's like, it's that trend of, as we all are aware
of... Yeah,
like,
the gritty reboot.
Remember in the Inception's... Yeah. In the trailer, everyone was like, that's a fucking good trailer.
Yeah.
That's
so
pretty,
now,
that's pretty good noise.
To this day, we're like, that should be a sound like that, a digital, like...
Right. Chris Nolan... is kind of the worst director for young filmmakers to try to imitate because it's never a great version of what he has done. It makes a lot of money, but no one's great at doing it other than him.
It kind
of there's a campiness of all superhero films, though. The man is a bat. That's stupid.
Right. There's a... You're asking a lot of us already when your main character has pointy ears.
Yeah,
like that.
And he's just
they're like really tall.
I'm a bad man.
And his head's. Oh, we'll get to that. So he pitched his idea, and he wanted to tell a Batman origin story, which at the time was novel because weirdly, this Batman Begins is the only Batman movie to date that has actually shown us how Bruce Wayne becomes Batman. We see his parents get shot a lot, but it's always in flashback. Like, this is the only one that actually brings us through the narrative of that happening and then how he comes from that little kid to Batman.
Yep.
So it seems like it's like a groaning, eye-rolling thing to say it's an origin story nowadays, but this at the time really was a unique idea for Batman. And there's a couple of comics that are referenced in the writing of this trilogy. The main ones are Batman Year One, The Long Halloween, and Nightfall. There's a couple other storylines that he referenced. He and screenwriter David S. Goyer referenced, but those are like the main ones.
And it depends on the film as well.
Right.
Let's talk about casting.
Christian Bale was the first choice for Batman. He's the first person that Nolan met with.
He was super excited about it, too, because he was a lifelong Batman.
But, sure, I think everybody is, right? Like, you'd be hard to find somebody that's like, fuck Batman.
Well, I'm not fuck Batman, but I'm going to out myself and say I haven't really read... comics until I was like in college. So Batman to me was, you know, Tim Burton's version.
Right. I did the same, but you know, I still knew Batman and
I knew
Tim Burton Batmans are a delight to watch.
They are fantastic.
Yeah, even
glorious
Joel,
films.
Yeah, even the Joel Schumacher ones. Like you're gonna tell me you go to Batman Forever and you're like, I'm not gonna watch this. If you're just killing time. You watch it every time.
No, yeah, you sit all the... It doesn't matter what point of the movie you turn it on, and you're like, I'm watching this to the end. Christian Bale was their first choice. Other people that read for it were a couple of regulars of Nolan's, sort of. Like Guy Pearce, obviously he had used Guy Pearce for Memento. He auditioned for Batman. Cillian Murphy, who wound up playing Scarecrow and also Fisher in Inception, he read for Batman or tried out for Batman. Jake Gyllenhaal.
Jake Gyllenhaal was interested and like actually like sought out the production. And I also thought it was interesting. Henry Cavill was considered. He tried out for Batman. And as an aside, Amy Adams was approached for Rachel Dawes. So you had your stars of the Man of Steel
that Nolan would produce.
Yeah, for Lois Lane and Superman. Yeah.
That's shocking to me because Nolan seems to have a thing for like dark hair, big eyed women.
Hot take, Bridget is right. Nolan has a type.
And this is the Batman movies are where a lot of his regulars first started. Like Michael Caine, who's been in pretty much every Nolan film since Batman Begins. Yeah.
Yes, he has.
Cillian Murphy obviously has shown up in a few. Ken Watanabe. Has shown up in a few.
Is it Watanabe or is it Watanabe?
I'm not sure.
Well, tell us, commenters.
Yeah.
I've always been pronouncing it Watanabe, but that's only because I know my name is Abe, and then I know that Abe is like a thing. Jonathan Crane, a.k.a. the Scarecrow, had an amazing list of people who possibly were going to be him. Ooh. Starting right off, Marilyn Manson.
Oh!
Christopher Eccleston, who's of Doctor Who fame and was later the villain in
Thor the Dark World.
Yeah, Thor 2. Ewan McGregor, which would be kind of interesting, because he would probably give an off-the-hinge kind of performance. Yeah. And Jeremy Davies. All good choices.
Yeah.
To me.
Marilyn Manson would have been so...
Marilyn Manson would have been like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that'd be gross.
That's like...
That'd been like stunt casting.
No, that'd be, that'd be like Sting and... Dune.
Which
was stunt casting.
But it was amazing.
There are actors that you have a hard time separating them as an actor from the role they're playing. Like, that's why I feel like a lot of people had such a hard time wrapping their heads around Batfleck. Because, like, Batman, you kind of want to be someone you know as the character they're playing.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. And Ben Affleck, you see Ben Affleck, and you know who that is.
Yeah,
right.
So Marilyn Manson, it would have been hard to walk away from.
Been distracting, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, I thought on Jack Gleason, who is, if you remember, from Game of Thrones.
He's
fan.
Little Joffrey.
Little Joffrey's
little Joffrey. Joffrey. He's yeah. a little boy in Batman Begins. Which is like a meme. Gives his little thing to.
I love yeah. the little meme on the internet. The little meme.
The meme.
Little guy.
For the little guy where they're just like, if Batman stopped him here, you know, like it would have been a completely different story. You know,
Batman just throws him off the balcony.
How dare
I didn't
you.
Realize that until the rewatch. And then, I mean, because obviously I haven't seen Batman Begins until I rewatched it for this. Yeah. And I stopped. I had a pause and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, because you didn't know. He was just
Tiny Joffrey.
That'll throw you.
Yeah.
I had the inverse when I first watched Game of Thrones. I was like, oh shit, that's a kid from Batman Begins.
Of course you did.
I think you're
that
the
is
only
a ridiculous
yeah.
recall.
Yeah.
So ridiculous. And I want to talk about like some of the acting preparation because this, you know, kind of needs to be said. In preparation for the Joker, Heath Ledger hid away in a motel room for 6 weeks during this seclusion. Ledger developed he dived deep into the psychology of the character. He based it off of Sid Vicious, Alex DeLarge from Clockwork Orange, and as the internet points out, a particular Tom Waits interview.
Very specific Tom Waits interview.
If you amazing. Haven't seen it, just search Joker Tom Waits in Google. You'll find it. It's crazy. All of the laugh,
mannerisms,
everything.
Yeah, the voice.
Yeah.
The voice is kind of a mix between Tom Waits and like James Cagney.
Right. It sounds so ridiculous, but once you say it, 100%. Yes, 100%. That is how he is doing a Tom Waits.
Quick bit about Heath Ledger. I remember when they were making, when Dark Knight was in production, there's rumors swirling around who was going to play the Joker. And I remember one of the big rumors was Paul Bettany.
Oh.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Don't hate it, but it's just such a seminal, like,
yeah.
thing.
It's hard to.
It's hard now, yeah, because we've had 9 years of the Joker.
That's also true of when Heath Ledger originally took the role. Jack Nicholson was like, don't do this because it messes you up psychologically.
In fact, he told Ledger, he was like, it's a crazy role to play. It's kind of terrible, but it's like, a lot of fun.
Yeah, he did tell that it never escapes you.
Yeah.
Another quick casting thing is when Dark Knight Rises was coming into development and nobody really knew what it was going to be yet, obviously, the big rumor was that the Riddler was going to show up because he was like kind of like the next tier of iconic Batman villain, and that's kind of what like the studio wanted. So the big speculation of who was going to play the Riddler was going between Robin Williams, just because they had it's a long-standing rumor. Like when they were during the original Batman series of movies, they were going to cast him for a while. Leonardo DiCaprio, who the studio was pushing for, and Johnny Depp was a rumor to play the Riddler.
Johnny Depp would have been good, and it kills me to say that.
He would have been, yeah.
Seeing Johnny Depp walk around as a Riddler for the next
would be.
In point of fact, there's a comic. But there's a comic that came out around the time of these rumors going around. It's just called Joker, and it's like kind of like a weird interpretation of the Batman's comic universe, where the Joker in that comic looks like Heath Ledger's Joker.
Right.
So all the characters are spun out of kind of that look, and the Riddler that they drew in that comic looks like Johnny Depp. So they really went for, this would be cool, but also, then...
Yeah.
There's no, just randomly, just like, why is all the rum gone?
Where'd the rum go? But they did hint at the Joker
in the end of Batman Begins. Yeah.
There was Mr. Reese, which, if you say it fast enough, is Mysteries, which is not elegant.
Mysteries.
Yeah.
Oh, they hinted at the Riddler in the end of
the
Dark
Riddler.
Knight.
Yeah, oh, okay. Sorry.
No, not
yeah.
the Joker.
They hinted at the Riddler.
Speaking of Leo, DiCaprio, Ryan Gosling, Mark Ruffalo were all considered for Robin for Dark Knight Rises before they went with JGL. DiCaprio also lost out to Chris O'Donnell for Batman Forever in 1995.
I can see that.
So he was up for the role twice and still... didn't get it.
When will he get a win?
I know, right? Well, he kind of chooses really good movies, though.
He does.
I mean, he kind of dodged a bullet with Batman Forever.
Yeah.
So who's on the team?
Wally Pfister, baby!
He's
all
back.
Three movies.
All three movies, and he nails it. I mean, there's so much.
He got at least one other Academy Award nod for his work on these films.
Yes.
For Batman Begins.
Yeah.
Maybe for Dark Knight as well, but...
I think so.
Definitely for Begins.
Yeah. Nathan Crowley's
and then
back.
Nathan Crowley is production designer.
Yep, from Prestige.
A lot of his films.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both did excellent work. I was just, Wally Pfister's maybe my favorite DP, but.
He's pretty awesome.
He's pretty awesome. Not a great director. If
oh no,
yeah, that was
transcendence.
Yeah,
no, that's Wally, right. no,
Wally.
That was disappointing. Really fell apart.
It was
in
like a '90s thriller that he made in 2014.
Looked good though.
It did. It looked great. Cool-ish idea. Just really fell apart. But every shot in the Batcave is beautiful, especially in Begins. Is what I really noticed. Like, there are a lot of long shots in Begins.
You know, that was a built set.
Oh, yeah.
There's no CG in that Batcave except for bats.
Let's get into that. Let's get into that production juice.
Yeah.
Because it's a Nolan movie, he tries to do as much as he can in camera, which is one reason why these movies cost so much, but it's also one reason why they look so good. And as Abe was just mentioning, Batcave is a big set that they built. They even ran fucking water. Like, they're just running water through it. You know, the big waterfall in all of them.
A lot of rocks.
A lot of rocks.
Yeah, every time I hear details about a production like this, my producer brain just kind of, like, gags a little bit. Just like, no.
No.
Stop. Don't do that.
If you have money and time.
If you have money and time,
which
they
had.
I have so much money.
You can accomplish a lot. There's other notable examples, though, right? Of times that it was in camera as opposed to where... Hollywood at this time would probably approach it with CG.
Right, because you remember this is mid-2000s, so we've already passed Lord of the Rings.
Right. The CG essence.
The Star Wars prequels.
We're on the CG train.
So we're all aboard the CG train.
Right.
But a surprising number of the big set pieces in this trilogy are done largely in camera. Like in the first movie, Batman dangling from the train and then the subsequent train crash that explodes Liam Neeson. That's a 1/6 scale model, the train crash, and Batman hanging from the train is just a stunt guy hanging from the train in the gigantic Gotham City set that they built in this huge hangar called Cardington, which is in England. It's a gigantic hangar. It's 160 or 170 feet tall. And the Gotham City sets that they built for Batman Begins were 150 feet tall. Like, they had the buildings. Like, they built the entire, like, Narrows neighborhood as a set. For Batman Begins.
Which is a model, but still a large model. 1/6 of a train is, like, still pretty
big. That's really big, yeah.
Yeah, it's a large object. And the reason why Nolan builds such huge freaking models is because it gives it the correct scale when you
right.
film it. Because otherwise, you know, you get that kind of fakey look to it.
It's like one of those trains that go through malls at Christmas time.
Yeah. Little right. children ride on it.
Yeah.
I love the bus crashing through the bank.
In Dark Knight, yeah.
Yeah, they, again, like they did in Inception, fired it out of an air cannon.
Yes, it was on a pneumatic track. They couldn't actually crash a bus to the wall of that building, because it's an actual building.
Yeah.
So they brought the bus inside and built a false wall and then just crashed it through with a cannon.
Right.
Because no one likes shooting cars at a cannon.
At a cannon.
I mean, who doesn't?
Right. Like the SWAT van that crashes in the river, also another car shot through a cannon.
Did Warner Brothers know what they were getting themselves into with Nolan?
I don't know. I think they stopped caring after they saw
it. I mean, yeah, it turned out to be worth it for them, but it was a big risk that I don't think they knew they were taking on.
Yeah, definitely in Begins when he decided to build all the exterior scenes in Gotham City as a big set, and then the Batcave is a gigantic set.
And the enormity of these sets, like, there's behind-the-scenes stuff that most of normal people who aren't a part of, like, they don't know. And I didn't know until I researched it, but, like, in Batman Begins in particular, if you remember the scene where Batman is being towed by a train through the streets of Gotham, so much steam was used, practical steam, that it would rain on the cast and crew for several minutes after the take.
Yeah.
That's just like, okay, so you're changing your environment just for a single shot. Yeah. What are we doing? Why are we expensive
pretending? And it's this massive interior environment, too. It was weirdly cost-effective because so much of the first film takes place at night outside.
Mm-hmm.
And these two guys can tell you that's a bitch.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a bitch.
But the worst.
But because it was an interior set, they could film anytime. Just make it look like night.
You have a grid at top to give you lighting. You know, you have standing things. You have control.
You have control of your
nighttime exteriors. You don't really have control. I mean, exterior in general, you don't have control, but nighttime especially so, because, like, I don't know, you don't have light is one thing, which is necessary. Photons are necessary for, you know, exposure of film.
Gotta have that sweet, sweet light.
Also, there's bugs.
So many bugs. And you have to go door to door and ask every neighbor's permission can I film this?
Yeah. Also, we're gonna take an 18-wheeler and just ram it
through. What are you filming in my neighborhood? Well, we're gonna flip a truck, and there's gonna be some explosions.
They had that in.
We've called every police department.
Yeah.
In The Dark Knight, when they explode Judge Shirlo's car, that's in a very wealthy neighborhood of Chicago. So they had to tell all these people, we're going to blow this car up. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. I also read that while they were doing a lot of chase scenes on the streets of Chicago, the police were getting tons of calls saying, there's a crazy chase outside my apartment. So the people of Chicago were freaking out. Clearly, the door-to-door thing didn't work.
In fact, it's funny you mention that because for Batman Begins in the streets of Chicago, a person some random civilian accidentally crashed into the Batmobile, and the driver was drunk.
Oh, no.
And he said he hit the car in a state of panic, believing that Dark Knight's vehicle was an invading alien spacecraft.
And he's drunk.
He's drunk. I mean, that's a pretty good excuse on the fly if you're hammered. You're like, I thought I was an alien, man.
I would be so scared if I crashed into the Batmobile.
Yeah. There's several crashes over the course of these films. Someone in Pittsburgh, when they were shooting Dark Knight Rises, the bat malfunctioned and hit the side of a Pittsburgh building, and they had to pay. They're insured. These things are insured, right, but they had to pay city of Pittsburgh was like, you just fucked up Pittsburgh.
Yeah. More notable examples, the 18-wheeler flip. They really flipped a big 18-wheeler in The Dark Knight when Joker's truck flips over. That's just a big old piston that they put inside a truck that just smashes into the ground to launch it end over end.
Also, they exploded a hospital for the same film.
Yeah, that's a real building demolition that they really had Heath Ledger walk outside of. They had to do that in one take because it's all they had. They wanted to blow the building up behind him. We already mentioned, the SWAT guys falling out of the building in the end of Dark Knight. That's a real stunt with real guys getting thrown out of a real building, which was apparently the Trump Tower under construction. Chicago.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, they filmed a lot by the Trump Tower.
Trump Tower shows up a lot in Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, because
he's very proud of that.
It was being constructed, so it had this cool look of for the end of the film, especially it had the cool look of being in degradation.
Right.
It also was across, the river so that it could look into the
so it would make geographical sense for it to be overlooking the two ferries.
The plane hijacking in Dark Knight.
Yes, plane hijacking, surprising amount of real stuff. It's real guys that jump out of the big plane on lines. That's a real stunt. It's real guys walking on the exterior of that plane.
That's insane.
And for when the fuselage gets tilted and broken for everyone to climb inside, that's an actual fuselage that's being dangled by a high-weight helicopter. So they had actual dudes climbing on this fuselage. It's actually hanging thousands of feet in the air for that shot.
So cool.
It's an amazing scene.
It's an amazing scene.
It's just the arrogance of Nolan just to be like, yeah, let's do it live.
Well, he wants it. Yeah, it's partially arrogance. Well, I mean, it's mostly arrogance.
And he can.
Yeah, but he can. He knows.
He's
a producer.
He's the best director to give that amount of money to because he won't waste it. He'll make it look great.
Yeah, and the result is a movie that doesn't date itself with its effects.
Right.
No. And he'll break IMAX cameras in the process.
He broke the shit out of an IMAX camera.
He broke, I feel like at this point, most of the IMAX cameras.
He's up there with Michael Bay in the most killingest camera director.
Camera killing. It's a bigger deal for IMAX, particularly when they were making The Dark Knight. The Dark Knight was the first film to ever, narrative film, I believe, to ever use an IMAX camera.
Yeah, for most of the production.
For a lot of it, yeah. They tested it on the bank robbery prologue scene, and when they saw how good that looked, they did all the aerials in the film were done with IMAX, and then a couple of the two big action sequences, which are the opening scene and then the chase.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the chase is where he broke one of the IMAX cameras. Yeah. And there's a quote from Chris Nolan where he's talking about that happening. And they actually used the shot in the film. It's when the Joker's semi-truck rear-ends the police van. That's when the camera got broken. And he's really bummed about it. He's like, there were only four IMAX cameras in the world. Now there's three.
Yeah. Today's episode is brought to you by the new Paramount Pictures film, Mother. A couple's relationship is tested when uninvited guests arrive at their home, disrupting their tranquil existence. From filmmaker Darren Aronofsky, who comes from things like Black Swan, Requiem for a Dream. I know that Pi was one of the reasons that I went to film school. It's just an amazing film, and it's his, I think his first. Mother stars Jennifer Lawrence, Javier Bardem, Ed Harris, and Michelle Pfeiffer in this riveting psychological thriller about love, devotion, and sacrifice. Mother is darkly intelligent. It's super well acted. And, you know, there's something about how Aronofsky is so good at tone. He can just make it feel the right type of dark every time. And he's nails it every time. He's really just nailed it every time. So I don't think it's going to be any different for this one. I think it's going to be one of the most controversial films to come out of Hollywood in a long time. It's the kind of smart and scary psychological thriller that Aronofsky is really known for, and it's probably going to create a lot of discussion after the credits have ended. Mother is out in theaters September 15th. Go and see it, and don't miss the movie everyone will be talking about. I want to tell you about another great show here at Earwolf, Throwing Shade. When a politician says something stupid, a celebrity tweets something ridiculous, or a tired meme is sweeping the nation, Brian and Aaron will be there to throw shade. Hosts Aaron Gibson and Brian Safi from Funny or Die and UCB are joined by great guests like Matt Bellassai, Lori Kilmartin, and Paul F. Tompkins. And they tackle important issues and treat them with far less respect than they deserve. Subscribe to Throwing Shade in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. New episodes every Thursday. The other things that are insane is in The Dark Knight. That's really fucking Christian Bale standing on top of the Sears Tower. That is not CG. He's looming over, you know, the city, and he's like, oh, there's crime down there. I'm going to get the crime.
Such a cool
sequence. That's over 100 stories high. And they're originally, of course, going to use a stunt double, but Bale insisted that he do it himself.
Yeah, I would too.
And there's like high winds and stuff. I mean, that makes the cape unfurl real cool, but what a badass.
Yeah. Also the sequence when he's getting ready to jump into Lau's building in Hong Kong. It's also him standing.
Also him. He's a big fan of that. When Christian Bale and Liam Neeson are fighting in the frozen lake and Batman Begins, they have both commented in interviews about how, like, yeah, when we were fighting, it was crazy because, like, the ice was, like, cracking beneath their feet. And they were like, that was, like, it looked really cool, but, like, we were a little scared on the day, but we were, like, pretty sure because we have a lot of faith in the production. The next day, the lake was completely melted.
Yeah, and I had read that that was going to be their shooting day. Like, the day that they actually filmed their fight scene on the frozen ice was supposed to be their prep day.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But then the next day, like Abe said, it was all melted.
Yeah, which, so.
I also feel like once you put on the costume of Batman, you can't be afraid of anything. Like, once he's already dressed in costume, he can't be like, I don't want to do this. Like,
I changed my mind.
Seeing Batman slink away because he thinks there's danger must be a great scary. Behind the scenes. He just gets to the top of the Sears Tower.
Right.
I don't want to do this.
No.
By the way, he lost his voice like multiple times time.
I'm sure he did. Yeah.
And he put it upon himself to make sure that every iteration of Batman was, like, deeper and lower and more, you know, glottal.
Yeah.
Just because he was just like, it needs to be even more Batman. And then Dark Knight comes in, even more Batman. Dark Knight Rises, even more Batman.
He speaks way less as Batman in Dark Knight Rises, though. Yeah. So it's not as notable.
That's true.
Oh, man. The main other thing I want to mention is just these freaking sets.
Yeah.
So like, many sets.
They built so many gigantic sets. In the first film, the Narrows, the Batcave. In the third film, they also went back to Cardington, which is that gigantic hangar, to build Bane's lair. Huge freaking sets.
Yeah.
And also, again, another trait of Nolan's is that there's an incredible amount of locations in each film.
Yes.
Yes.
So many.
In fact, my notable one is, if you're a fan of the podcast, you know that I love The Mummy. Wayne Manor is the same. If you watch the second Mummy, that's the O'Connell Mansion. That's all I wanted to say.
That's all.
It's just that if you look at those two films, you'll go, oh, it's the same. It's the same location. It's the Mentmore Towers, and it's also been in Brazil and Eyes Wide Shut.
Ooh.
An unforeseen problem that the Ninja Training Academy, in the Ninja Training Academy, was that Liam Neeson is super tall, and all of their stunt guys were shorter. So when you see him walking around them and, like, you know, taunting Bruce, think of all of those ninjas on wooden blocks, and they're called apple boxes. Likewise, Tom Hardy in Dark Knight Rises is 5'9", and he had to wear, anytime you see Tom Hardy next to Christian Bale, Morgan Freeman, or Michael Caine, he's wearing 3-inch lifts to make him appear taller. That's just something, you know, when you're watching it, that will probably ruin it for you.
He had a neat interview I saw with Tom Hardy where he was talking about he was feeling pretty good about himself because he, you know, he'd put on a lot
of... He got super swole.
He did. He got swole to be Bane. He was like, yeah, I was feeling pretty good about myself. And I saw Christian Bale over there. I'm like, yeah, he's kind of reedy. I'm good. I can take it. And then when he gets into his costume and then Bale's in his costume and he's standing in front of him and he's like two heads taller than me and he's like, Batman. he's like, I just had a moment where I was like 6 years old and I was like,
that's right. Batman Begins. It took 129 shooting days, which is an eternity.
So many.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's way more than
that's
I expected.
Way more. Most that's like 60 is like a handsome amount. And so that was more than double.
It's a charming amount.
Yeah. And here's the crazy thing. The reason it took that long, or one of the reasons, because obviously the production's huge, but Nolan wanted to oversee every shot of the film personally. There's no B unit in Batman Begins.
I have read that.
That's infuriating.
I've read that's the case on a lot of his films.
It's a, yeah.
He doesn't do second unit.
He didn't do that as much in the second and third, and since hasn't because he's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger.
Right, yeah, his productions have grown.
You can't justify getting hundreds of people there and spending tens of thousands of dollars a day, if not more, just so that you can get a few extra like B unit shots.
You B industry, unit. You two industry folk, if you guys want to just... let the readers know real quick what typically B unit or second unit shooting is.
So, yeah, so typically, like, if you have, like, establishing shots where there's not a lot of action or it's just, like, an extra who's dressed up as Batman running around or, like, a great shot would be...
like, inserts of...
Get a B unit director and a B unit cinematographer or the same cinematographer. It depends, you know, every production is different. And that saves a lot of money because now the director doesn't have to use that time. He can be using it elsewhere while the production's up and running. So B unit is typically for shots that don't need, you know, like acting as much is a typical rule of thumb. Speaking of acting, there's so many good Ledger stories, which I'm sure people have already dived into, but a few ones that jumped out at me is the Aaron Eckhart scene in the hospital is amazing because apparently, according to Eckhart, when they would roll and then Ledger would just walk around in character mumbling to himself in like a weird way. And Eckhart just didn't know what to do. So he was just watching him, waiting for the first lines to be said. And it usually go on for a few minutes until Ledger got close to him. And at one point, if you remember in the film, one take, Ledger like lurches at him. And that's Eckhart not actually, that wasn't a planned lurch because Eckhart kind of like, raises his hand up in defense. That's him going like, is Ledger as a method actor going to punch me right now for no reason? Like he was just like knee-jerk reaction. And then immediately after Ledger grabbed Eckhart's hand in like an equally like fierce manner. And afterward Ledger told Eckhart, that's what acting's all about.
And just like top hat and cane.
You did good. You grabbed me and I did this thing and it was weird. And it, beep, beep, beep. What? And, it,
and tap dances out of the way.
Also, before the interrogation scene in Dark Knight, Heath Ledger told Christian Bale to hit him as hard as he could.
Why?
So that because he's Batman and he's really hitting the Joker. Yeah. Before we jump into post-production, one other thing that I want to mention, just because I'm a football fan and maybe some of you out there, is in Dark Knight Rises, in the football sequence, there was 10,000 extras to shoot that scene, and it was in Heinz Field in Pittsburgh, and some of the Steelers were the football players. I'm sure some even noticed Ben Roethlisberger's in a shot. It's
patriotically.
Yeah.
Being a patriot.
Mike Wallace, former Steelers coach, was the coach of the Rogues. And the mayor of Pittsburgh played the kicker at the time.
Yeah, because apparently he had played in college or something.
Yeah.
So he's the guy that does the kick, and it's actually his name on the back of the kicker's jersey.
And that is actually Heinz Ward running away.
Heinz Ward, yeah.
Yeah.
He's the only survivor.
Only one that lives.
Yeah.
Good old Heinz Ward.
He gets out of there.
Let's talk about post-production. Something that I found in my research is that the average length of shot, meaning in the edit in Batman Begins, is 1.9 seconds. That's the average they did, which is super fast. Which, if you remember, and we all talked about before, Batman Begins is like the most efficient of all the three films in terms of like that thing moves.
Yeah.
Also, in terms of it's kind of like an editorial style that was like Greengrass had done it in Born Identity and stuff like that. The editorial style of the fights, someone actually found out that you never actually see a frame in Batman Begins where Batman hits anyone. What? They cut away right before the punch.
That's
and then the lurch, like you never actually see contact, which I thought was like a crazy artifact of that editorial style.
Yeah, and it's still something that happens to this day.
Yeah, it still does.
It's a weird... you're right. It's a strange artifact. Yeah.
Which is the reverse of if you talk to someone who's like an old style, like Jackie Chan, they double up punches.
There's a very good episode of Every Frame of Painting.
Yes.
Which is an excellent YouTube series that talks about this. You should go search for it. But it points out the difference between the Jackie Chan stuff and then...
Because he was all about do it in the wide so that you actually believe you get to see he did hits. It.
Right.
I thought Nolan had an interesting reason for doing it. At least in Batman Begins, he said that was a deliberate choice he made because he wanted to film the fights from the criminal's perspective.
Right.
In which case, Batman's disorienting. You never get a good look at him.
Yeah, he's gone before he's there. Yeah, stuff like that. I thought that's smart. For a series of films, if that's your angle, like that's a cool thing. Especially, it's a limitation. Yeah.
In that movie where everything is disorientating, like that's... kind of the theme throughout the movie is and how confused you are and how scary Batman looks when everyone's ingested that poison that makes you scared of everything. Yeah. It's super kind of confusing to watch, but
they breathed in that spooky juice.
That spooky blue flower juice.
Now everyone's got the creeps.
For The Dark Knight, and because we're talking about IMAX prints about specifically this film, there's a lot of IMAX. We say that and you go, okay, yeah. It started off as that thing that you'd see at like a National Geographic.
Documentaries
and
primarily.
And then for this film, you know, got into feature filmmaking. Now, what that means to people is it's like 35 millimeters typical, you know, anamorphic or, you know, the film plane. That's 35 millimeters across. This is 70 millimeters. So it's a lot larger, but it's also just a wider format. It's also taller format, and it comes from an old thing called VistaVision. But here's the thing that is interesting about it. Because they mastered this whole thing and the entire film print was IMAX, it consisted of 45 reels altogether. Were roughly, if you put it all together to watch the film in IMAX, that's 9.5 miles long, and the whole thing weighed 450 pounds. That's just the film. If you're a projectionist, you hated displaying this film, is my point.
And because of how big it is, again, correct me if I'm wrong, I read that IMAX camera only carries 3-minute loads.
Something like that. They may have bigger magazines now, but like that was where the industry started. And that's because mainly it was documentary filmmaking. So just be get this like Planet Earth kind of stuff. Just like get this cool shot of like the Alps. And then roll on that for a while and get the wind kicks up. All right, let's, you know, shift it over. But it's mainly because of the practicality of, like, these things are heavy and, like, we got to be on the move, so let's make small magazines. Yeah. Speaking of video, though, you were mentioning, Heath Ledger directed the home video footage in Dark Knight. Nolan had no part of that. He said he gave him, he's like, you can do it yourself. And when he came back with the footage, you know, where it's him, like, messing with the fake Batman and turning the camera to his own face.
And then messing with Anthony Michael Hall.
Yeah, exactly. He was so pleased that it's what you see in the movies. Like, that he didn't, like, go back and reshoot it. Because it started off as a thing where, like, Heath Ledger was like, can I try something? And he was like, yeah, go ahead. And then when he saw it, he was like, you know what, we're just going to use
so
that.
So he did allow some second
use.
That was Batman Begins. This is Dark Knight.
Okay.
All
right. How pissed are you, though, if you're, like, top-tier B-unit director and cinematographer? And they were like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, Heath Ledger. That's fine.
Yeah, let him do it.
I have a family to feed. It's fine.
Tom Hardy had to re-record a lot of lines in Dark Knight Rises because the initial cuts came out with a lot of comments that he was illegible.
When I was watching Batman Begins, that one's obvious because Bane's voice is insane in these movies.
Dark Knight Rises, you mean.
In Dark Knight Rises. But even in Begins, I noticed anytime Gordon talks into a walkie, I'm pretty sure that seems to be ADR because Gary Oldman's mouth is so off. And also, I'm not sure what Gary Oldman's voice sounds like. I realized in watching this.
He does speak very quietly. I'd also heard that a lot of the IMAX stuff had to be ADR. Like, I think I had read definitely on Dark Knight that the IMAX footage, none of the natural sound was used.
Yeah. Also, Bane's boots, remember 3-inch heels? Bane's boots were so loud on, like, the grates and stuff that, like, things couldn't like they just had to re-record
that
everything.
Voice is lunacy. It's like
it's
the
insane.
Best.
It's the greatest gift, I think. That's what it's because it's so much fun to do.
Oh, yeah.
My favorite cultural phenomenon was as soon as that film came out in 2012. Everyone was like,
what matters is our plan.
I was born in it.
Yeah. I was born in it.
Everyone did it, and then like within 3 months at least, when you work at a comedy website, you're just like, ah, fuck off.
Yeah, but it's super
I'm done with this.
It's still fun.
It's still fun.
It's fun to do.
I'm looking back 5 years later.
I had read that his decision to do that is he wanted to make a real dichotomy between the way he looked and the way he sounded.
I love that choice. That's such a Tom Hardy like choice. I know it's known, but like that's also perfect utility of Tom Hardy.
There is no fucking way Christopher Nolan took him aside and said, do this voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you should talk like this.
Now is not the time to die.
Yeah. I mean, after...
Then you have my permission to die.
I think after Heath Ledger and that tour de force and the fact that he died in the scope of the film, or at least before it got released, those are such huge boots to fill. And I think that Tom Hardy is the perfect choice because he's equally, like, bombastic of a performer. Like, he absolutely... he owns every scene.
He does.
And in a lot of ways, like, a lot of us didn't like the film when it first came out. And, Bridget, we were talking about how... This is only the second time that I've seen Dark Knight Rises. I saw it in theaters, and I hadn't watched it for a long time, and then I watched it this week. And I remember liking it this week a lot more than when it came out. And I think that that might be, like, the cultural phenomenon of, like, that Dark Knight Rises was set up to fail. It's not by any stretch of the imagination.
It's by no means a failure either.
No. But. Yeah, it's not a great film for Nolan. It's not a failure. But, like, it carried with it all this baggage that I just... Maybe each of you probably have your own opinion about this, but like something I like to think about is about like, oh, it's when you watch a movie, it's not just you're not walking into it with just like a clean slate. You're watching it with the time.
The cultural hype and, of it. Yeah. The immediacy of it.
I super liked Dark Knight Rises when I saw it. I saw it twice in theaters, like back to back.
It's a lot of fun. I want to talk about the release for a brief period. Batman Begins inspired James Bond's producers, Michael Wilson and Barbara Broccoli, to reboot the James Bond franchise. So if you liked Casino Royale in 2006,
and who didn't?
You have Batman to thank.
Yeah.
It's because they were like, oh, this is cool. They're taking something that's like fairly campy, which James Bond also is, but they're making him darker and grittier and more realistic.
Reality-based,
And so that's what they did with James Bond there. Batman Begins was the first film that was directed and written by Nolan to be rated PG-13 in the U.S., which is crazy. But I think that it makes a lot of sense given the, you know, like the atmosphere in the United States, you couldn't make a blockbuster R film, which we're starting to undo right now.
And since then, he hasn't made any R-rated movies.
No, he hasn't, because he's too big to fail, so he can't take big risks like that anymore. Dark Knight made more money than Batman Begins' entire domestic run in 6 days.
Yeah.
That adds up to me. That checks out. Your facts check
the
out.
The hype train was so gargantuan for the Dark
Knight.
Yeah,
because Batman Begins was amazing, and Dark Knight looked at like, oh, Joker. Oh,
it had so much hype. You know, they had built up the viral marketing, and then, you know, again, it's sad to say, but Heath Ledger's death also contributed to the hype behind this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and his posthumous Best Actor in a Supporting Role Oscar win marked the first time that an Academy Award had been given to in a major category to a comic book movie.
That's the one that deserves it.
Yeah, if we're going to give it to anyone, give it to the one that has ruined comic book movies forever.
for
now,
decades.
Every comic book villain is about what dumb voice is this guy going to
do. Give it to the best villain.
Yeah.
That's how the movie was made. Now let's get into some observations in a segment we call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret Things.
In Dark Knight Rises, Jonathan Crane, a.k.a. the Scarecrow, first appears as a judge. And he's wearing a tattered cloak that looks like it has straws coming out of his shoulders. Because he's
a scarecrow.
Some symbolism you may or you may not have noticed. The bat symbol logo and the marketing of each film foreshadow something that happens later, usually the set piece. In Batman Begins, it's made of bats, symbolizes Batman using the sonar to call the bats to distract the cops while he escapes from Arkham. In Dark Knight, it's fire to represent the flames of the hospital explosion that scars Harvey Dent.
Then the various explosions, the warehouse.
Just the idea of fire represents a film. And then in Dark Knight Rises,
it's the ice.
It's made up of crackling ice to represent people falling through the icy river as they're forced to walk through it.
There's a couple of things. This is just a dumb thing right here, but like the movies are written by David S. Goyer. At least he's attached in all of them. And the villain saying some sort of theatrical thing, and then the hero going, "I'm gonna stop you.
I'm gonna stop you."
It's something that shows up in a lot of David S. Goyer movies. It's in Batman Begins and in The Dark Knight Rises, and then it also shows up in Man of Steel. Which
so it's like what it's a weird cross. Line.
Yeah. Well, it's a cross because it's always like the villain saying something cool. Like, you know, Liam Neeson gives this whole speech about how to burn your house down, and then Batman's like, "I am gonna stop you," and I'm like, "Okay, that's cool." And then Dark Knight Rises, like. You know, he walks to the crowd of cops, and then Bane's like, "You came back to die with your city?" Yeah. And then he's like, "I came back to stop you."
So writers have that, though. Writers have Sorkinisms.
But those are cooler lines. Dark Knight Rises, heavily influenced by Tale of Two Cities, the Charles Dickens novel. One of Daggett's, one of the Wayne Enterprises villains, his sidekick guy is named Stryver, which is a character in that novel.
You hear his name when he's on trial,
right.
And he's one of the lawyers in the book.
Yeah, and he's one of the lawyers. A lot of the characters have similar patterns. Ice Spark noted Tale of Two Cities,
well,
if Selena I'm being
Kyle
honest.
Says and, a yes, line in it.
Yeah,
a storm is coming,
which is a direct reference.
Right. Bane is knitting in the courtroom, which is like you so have weird. To really look for it, but like I found deep, this on IMDb. Yeah. But that's, an allusion, given all the things that are being said that are related to the book. Madame Defarge, I believe is how you say it. She knits while she watches guillotine executions. Mm-hmm.
There's a daughter and estranged father dynamic in that book.
Go
a lot
literacy.
Of a lot of Tale of Two Cities. Dark Knight Rises.
College people. So what's this movie secretly about? Like our room 237?
Man, there's a couple of things.
Yeah, I got a few things. I'll start us off.
Yeah.
This Nolan month, we've had this dive about how Nolan's movies are all about the mind. In Memento, it's about the repression of grief. In Inception, it's the infection of ideas. Prestige, the power of obsession. Interstellar, the strength of love. I'd argue that the Batman franchise is about the preservation of will. And what I mean by that is Batman's enemies attempt to disrupt his psychological commitment to being a symbol of justice, which is his main goal. So most notably in Dark Knight, you have the comment about like the immovable object versus unstoppable force scene. And the Joker says, quote, "He's like a dog chasing a car. He doesn't know what he's going to do when he caught it." The tactic is most employed by like his 3 to 5 enemies, like Ra's al Ghul, Scarecrow, Bane, Joker. Their goal isn't to necessarily best him in combat. Like, they all seem to be either an equal level
or...
I'll try to break him, not... Yes, I mean, Bane literally finally does the physical one.
Right.
But on the line that he actually, like, drops him on, he's
You're right.
He was like, I've broken your mind, now I've broken your will, I'm going to break your body.
Well, he says, I was wondering what was going to break first, your spirit or
your
body.
Spirit, your
so
spirit.
He breaks his body, but then he throws him in the pit to break his spirit.
Yeah.
Right. So they use fear against him. So it's more about Batman beating himself, him losing the battle of being Batman, rather than them beating him in combat, hand-to-hand combat. So the war is truly not for Gotham, but its most prized son's mind.
Yeah. The movies are kind of about duality, which goes in line with Nolan's themes. But
I
think it's more about his inability to be Bruce Wayne than his inability to be Batman. He hates being Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. It's. I think Rachel Dawes even says, like, when you can stop being Batman, when you can take off also your Bruce Wayne mask,
then we
can be together.
Well, yeah, and she says, I don't think it's ever going to... When you're done with Batman, but I forget how she phrases it.
Yeah, she phrases it.
When the world no longer needs him, but I don't think there's going to be a time when you no longer need him.
Yeah.
There's so many parts in the first two, really all three movies, where we see he just super resents having to be Bruce Wayne. And that comes from the comics, too.
He doesn't have a family. He's been emotionally distressed around the same time.
He doesn't want to live in the house. Yeah. Michael Caine's been like, "Don't ruin, that's your father's name. It's all, and it's all that's left of him." Like, he keeps... Yeah.
When you see in Batman Begins, young Bruce Wayne...
He hates it.
Yeah. The only scenes are about him and rage.
Yeah.
About
how
he's just like, I want to kill him.
Well, also, Bruce Wayne never dealt with the death of his parents. He kind of locked himself in the anger stage of the process and moved on to it through Batman, which was also just a way to lock himself in anger.
Is kind of crazy and unheard of, just because usually, you know, humans work that out.
Yeah.
You know, it's an unfortunate thing, grief, but he did have Alfred, and Alfred is loving. So why didn't Alfred, take him to counseling?
There's a lot of things with that, but... Yeah, just to complete the thought. Anytime,
what more do you want from Alfred?
Well, I want him to not leave during Dark Knight Rises.
Right.
That's
Don't leave us, Alfred.
Yeah. Anytime he when he tries to be both Bruce Wayne and Batman, it works out terribly for him. Like, yeah. His house gets burned down. He pushes Rachel away. She gets killed. Harvey Dent gets killed. Things go to shit. And then when he has to be Bruce Wayne, he's just despondent. Like, he resents it in the first two films. And then in the third film, we see he's been a recluse for 8 years. Like, he's depressed. Right. Like,
Because he doesn't have Batman anymore.
Yeah,
because
he can't be Batman.
And he just has to be Bruce Wayne, and he can't deal with it.
Right. And he hates it.
Yeah.
So the end of the movie ends with him finally reconciling that and being able to leave Batman behind and just be Bruce Wayne now.
His relationship with women, like that arc is seen through his relationship with women, because I feel like he's so fixated on Rachel and wants her, even though he says he's accepting of her relationship with Harvey. Clearly,
he's super not.
He's super not. He's very passive aggressive with Harvey.
Jokes him out.
Yeah, or aggressive aggressive. You know,
that's Batman.
That's Batman's version of. Because Rachel sees that in him, and then with Catwoman, he kind of sees a person who he can relate to as these two different people, as this person who just wants a clean slate and wants to start over.
Mm-hmm.
She can kind of help him through that a little bit. She understands and can help him separate Bruce Wayne and be a full person as Bruce Wayne. Well,
she's the only one in the entire trilogy to be sympathetic to his pain in a way that is like, you need to fix this.
Yeah.
Because even Alfred is like encouraging whatever you want to do, buddy.
Well, but he's sort of against Batman too. Like he's lecturing him constantly about being Batman through all three movies. And then he eventually leaves in Dark Knight Rises because he says, you're only doing this because you want to die. And it's true when he starts. Like he wants to die as Batman because he hates being Bruce Wayne.
Right.
But you're right. Rachel is angry at him for his pain.
Taking it wrong way. Running with it.
And I think he's only fixated on Rachel because he knew her from back before the pain started, like before his parents died.
Right. Yeah.
So he just likes her.
She knew
her because,
happy Bruce Wayne.
Right. She represents that point in his life.
I guess what I mean is that Alfred knows that he is Batman. So he's angry at him for like turning this pain into this direction.
Yes.
But she doesn't know that he's Batman yet. And until the point that she does, she's still angry at him for taking it the wrong way. So she's the only one who's really like, look, man, you got to stop. You're psychologically not dealing with it.
Oh, you're talking about Rachel.
Rachel. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because Selina Kyle is, I think, the only person in his life who's like, you need to deal with this. You need to deal with it as Batman and then as Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
She's very blunt
with
him.
She's sympathetic to him, though.
She's sympathetic while being blunt and say, deal with this right now. I'm going to deal with my stuff and help you do that. But she's just the best. She's just so great.
But she also has the same problem.
She has the same problem.
Yeah, she does.
She does. Yeah.
Which is why she acknowledges it. But I'm like, who are you to talk?
But she's also trying to escape it, and she's working on it and taking active steps to. She's seeking out this clean slate program so she can start over. And
she also doesn't hate being Selina Kyle. Like, she sort of slides effortlessly. Yeah, of course.
Why would
she? She kind of goes effortlessly in and out of being Selina Catwoman and Selina
I don't
Kyle.
Know if I agree with that, just because what's the name? Because might just be because of canon, but I forget the name of it. But the Juno Temple is in, like, six
Maggie.
Shots.
Yeah.
Yeah, is her. Like, so she has, like, a
who's not named
orphan
correctly.
That she's like, I'm going to raise you and, like, you'll be my protege. And that's not the act of someone who hates themselves.
No, she doesn't hate herself. She knows how to handle herself.
She does.
And that's one of the best qualities and why I admire Catwoman so much. God, I love Catwoman. I just want to be her. Goat woman, am I right?
That's so good. Okay, we're going to segue to a segment where we talks about the scenes that would be enhanced, or maybe they ruin the plot, in a segment we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed.
It would have been delightful to see Ducard/Ra's al Ghul, Liam Neeson, cramming all those bats into that little box. It's just trying to herd all these bats.
I mean, really, the whole run up to that scene would have been
production.
The whole rehearsal that he must have had with the other members of the League of Shadows also to do that choreography of confusing Batman. Just like he heard the bat and he goes, okay, guys, now 5, 6, 7, 8. And
like, all right, now when I say this word, everyone is going to move to the left.
All right, I gave you all numbers. 2 and 3 move right at the same time.
See, I thought that's interesting because I thought that that chest was essentially the equivalent of a Harry Potter boggart. Am I getting that right? Like he right. gave him a drug and said,
oh, he was going to see whatever he wanted.
Is in that right. chest. Open the chest.
Well, I think he knows that his fear is bats.
Exactly, or subconsciously.
So it right. could be.
So it, there could I'm be
saying,
zero bats.
I'm saying Liam Neeson knew that his fear was bats.
Oh, okay.
I also, it could be either way, but I want to imagine no, he crammed all those bats in there.
That's fucking hilarious to me, is him going, goddamn bats, they're so yeah. hard to grab.
Also, that scene where Liam Neeson asks Bruce Wayne what his biggest fear is. Bruce never says bats, but that's not the answer he was looking for. Bats isn't the answer. Like, I don't like snails. That's my biggest fear. But, like, if I said snails, I'm terrified of snails.
You're scared of snails?
Hate snails.
Hating and scared of is different.
No. I disagree. But, like, so my answer to that would have been snails. But, like, that's not the... He's like, snail? Not, like, death or, like, yourself? Like, or, like, knowing, like, something more thematic than bats?
Are
like
you sure
an
you're
animal?
Not scared of failure? Or
what about... No,
looking
sharks.
Your parents, perhaps.
You're afraid of sharks. Okay, sharks. Sharks it is. Gotta get sharks.
Yeah. Sharks I can work with, but snails. There's no snails on these mountains.
Yeah. You heard it here first. Bridget is secretly snail woman.
No. No.
It's time my enemies knew my dread.
In Dark Knight Rises, so there's a scene where Robin and Batman, when they first interact in Dark Knight Rises... Mm-hmm. Where what they do is he fires a little thing and he's like, I need something bigger because they're blowing a hole into the subway station, which was...
Yeah, it was where the cops are trapped.
So 5 months ago that happened and then all the cops run out. So they've just been in there for 5 months surviving?
No, we see them lowering them supplies. Like they're keeping the police... Like Bane's keeping the police alive. He's just keeping them locked in the sewer.
Okay. That's the scenes I want to see.
Yeah.
Where they're just like sitting there for 5 months like... So, should we be cannibals?
Yeah, there's another movie, Gotham PD.
We maybe start climbing on each other's shoulders? I think we could reach that hole.
Anyone want to try?
They have one piece of clothing that they've worn for 5 months, and they all look impeccably clean.
Yeah, they're all clean shaven, too.
Not one, but two explosions.
They're all clean shaven, too. Yeah,
so they're cleaning each other's...
Batman leaving that trail of gasoline up the side of the bridge and then a giant bat symbol. That probably took some time.
I like to think that the way they're
standing... He didn't really have to waste. The bomb's going to explode in 12 hours, but I need to do this. It's going to be so
Also, I mean, the scene we all need. It's Batman ejecting himself in Dark Knight Rises from the Batwing.
6 miles.
Yeah.
Away from an explosion so that he doesn't die.
So he doesn't get vaporized. Yeah,
they really hammered in some points there, but I just want to see the woohoo.
I just want one more comment. My last one is I like to think to myself that the way they kept their police suits clean is that they just adopted the idea of cats where they just licked each other
and made each other clean. Licking each other clean. Yeah.
We're Gotham PD. All right, that's
They all come out as Catwoman. Just Catwoman.
They're all cats. You know how it is. It's a theme. So we watched the movie. Now let's make some observations that most of us haven't thought of, perhaps, in a short segment we're calling Let's Overthink It.
First, all of Rachel's relationships involve men... Or exchanging small trinkets with dangerous men. Like, it's the arrowhead with Bruce, and then it's Harvey's coin. And then after she explodes with Harvey's coin, like, Batman picks up the coin and then brings it to Harvey's hospital room and leaves it on his table. And one side is all fucked up from the explosion that vaporized his fiance.
Probably has, like, a piece of his flesh burned into it.
Yeah, like, her hair is probably stuck to it. Probably smells, like, vaguely like fried Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
Why would he want that? Why would you bring that to him?
Just to, like, sniff it every now and then.
I mean,
No!
They have a very passive-aggressive relationship. I feel like that's Batman's
Batman's, like, leaving it there, like, fuck you.
Yeah.
I have one other comment, and it's that I can't, they redesigned Batman's costume between the first two movies, right?
Right, so he could have more mobility.
So he could have more mobility, which, in theory, is fine, but they kept the mask part the same. So his head is, like, oddly bulbous.
Yeah.
I cannot take him seriously because he looks like a cat that you waited too long to neuter.
Is that what happens to cats if you wait too long to neuter? Their heads get really big?
Yeah.
Yeah, the back of their head, like, because something, I don't know, glands?
It's some hormonal thing, but he just looks, he's just got this big-ass head with his ears, and it's like, I can't, and then he's doing that. It's like, all right.
I'm a cat. I mean a bat.
It's a wonderful movie, but... The sweet movies.
He's got a stupid head. Yeah, I have a kind of theory that Joker is like an evil timeline Batman.
What?
Yeah. Insane.
I will go on. So the whole movie is kind of Batman railing against institutions in a way. The
Dark Knight specifically, or the
the trilogy as a whole.
Vigilantism.
And so, I mean, the Joker's not a vigilante, but he is this rogue guy creating chaos. Because even when he fights Bane, who is also railing against an institution in a way, not a very coherent way. So he operates outside. He wants the individual to fight for good. And that's Batman's ideal world is kind of this libertarian, you know, good men rise up to stop evil and go off their own will. The Joker is kind of the antithesis of this because the Joker also doesn't operate in institutions. He tries to work with the mob only to jab a pencil through their heads and burn all their money.
But his goal seems to just be an agent of chaos.
Chaos, which Batman is just an agent of good. So if, Batman at a moment decided he didn't want to fight for good, if Batman was born and just had a predilection for evil, instead he would be the Joker.
I think if we're going to go to D&D, Joker's chaotic neutral.
Joker's right. Chaotic evil.
Chaotic evil,
chaotic
sorry.
Evil.
And
Batman's chaotic good.
Chaotic good.
Good. Yeah. So, yeah, just Batman and his ethos flip, and you get the Joker. But I think by the end, what makes the trilogy work so well as a whole is that Batman ultimately has to create an institution for him to be a free man as Bruce Wayne.
Right.
He creates this institution of Batman, this symbol for good for people to fill out. So, and also to defeat the Joker, he uses institutional overreach.
He does.
He uses
the Patriot Act.
Yeah, he uses the Patriot Act. uses the same, like, this is meant for good, but it's kind of harmful technology. To catch this guy, he goes outside of his own values.
He also wants to kiss.
He does want to kiss.
He wants to make smooches.
Yeah.
Smoochies.
Bad timing, smoochy. But anyway, Joker, evil timeline Batman.
Yeah, I like that. A lot. Chaotic Reflections. That's what I'm taking away.
It's the name of my album, Chaotic Reflections.
Chaotic Reflections.
And it's you doing your daily affirmation. Yeah. I'm Catwoman.
See, I thought Chaotic Reflections, a song by Dashboard Confession.
Doing the Olin Mills chin on fist pose.
Right. In one, it's me looking at myself as me in the mirror. It's Catwoman.
Yeah.
Chaotic Reflections.
I buy that.
Out September 21st.
I buy that. So we talked about how a movie was made and how some things were problematic. We're going to start this thing where we've been doing it, but we're probably only going to do it at the end of the month from here on in. We'd like to talk about whether or not this should go on the gold record we send into space. In other words, of the movies that we've talked about with this director or all of their movies, the big question is, do we send this movie to the aliens? Of all of the films that we talked about in this podcast about Nolan, I'm going to run with Interstellar, just because that one is the one where we show that even if we are destructive as a race, we still have this thing that we call love. And it's what bands us all together, and it makes us persist. And it's kind of a beautiful message that I would like to send the movies to aliens. Also shows that we're spacefaring. So, you know.
Right. And you think in terms of preserving for all time on a gold record in space.
For
Interstellar's the one for Christopher Nolan.
I think so.
I like that. And I really like what you said, because as far as, like, our ideas of aliens are, like, well, what separates us from other people is our emotional ability to love each other and stuff like that. I like that. Not one I'm going to pick.
What are you going with?
I'm having a real hard time. I'm going to choose one of these movies. I'm having a real hard time between Dark Knight or Batman Begins on the fly. I'm going to go Batman Begins. I think
bold choice.
It is a bold choice. I know, but I think if we're showing what our society is like and how we coped with tragedies and moving on, these movies are uniquely post 9/11.
Very much so, yeah.
That's a major kind of undercurrent theme, and I think it's a good, even though it's, you know, superheroes, fantastical, it's a good marker for where society was at and how we tried to move forward and build ourselves up and kind of the values we hold of good and evil and how we come together.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Little self-plug here. I have a video I did for the site where I talk about how Batman uniquely, all of Batman's movies uniquely reflect the time in which they were made.
Yeah.
And whole big section about the 9/11 stuff. Shit. I'm going to say... I'm going to go with Inception.
Nice, rounding it out.
Yeah.
So we all disagreed.
We all disagree. Why? I'm going to say Inception because I think it's Nolan's most influential original film.
Mm-hmm.
The most original and the most influential in terms of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still an important film. It holds up. It's still a good film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I would pick that one. Watch this, Aliens.
So you heard Inception from Tom, Interstellar from Abe, Batman Begins.
Yeah.
As the official Nolan canon.
Yeah, let us know what you guys think.
Yeah,
yeah.
Can you best us?
Out of all of these.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be specific to Aliens. I tied that in because I was like, it's kind of cute. But like, we're really talking about what's our favorite, and yeah, what's the posterity of his career.
Also, do you think the aliens will be like, do you think they're the aliens?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are they all Batman?
So we're done here, but we wanted to talk about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod. Please hit us up with your thoughts, people. We've been Abe.
I'm Tom.
And
Catwoman, also known as Bridget. Bridget, I'm Bridget.
Bridget. Chaotic Reflections, September 29th.
Yeah.
Bridget, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Bridget Tweets. Bridget with two T's, tweets with one. So it's three T's in a row. It's inelegant, but
Bridget
tweets. You'll figure it out.
You're a hilarious human being.
Thank you.
We've been honored that you've joined us. Next week.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So next week, people, we'll be talking about a new director. That's it for Nolan. That was 5 months. You got a five.
We're done
or
with
five
Nolan.
Weeks. So you got five Nolans. But this next month, we're going to do four for September. So expect that we're going to talk about four Catherine Bigelow movies
next month.
And we're going to start right off the bat with The Hurt Locker.
That's right.
As a reminder, as I said up top, the Crack Movie Club will be at the UCB Sunset Theater on Saturday, September 9th at 7 p.m. here in Los Angeles. We're going to dissect, it will probably be the third installment, but 1991's Point Break. If you can, come join us and look for that episode in the future. Details to buy tickets.
I think it's going to be in the episode description.
Yes, it will.
So click that link, buy some ticks.
Yep, smash that mouse button.
Yeah, come watch us talk about Point Break, the old one, not the new one.
That's it.
Yep.
Watch on, movie people.
Hey, I'm Brian Safi.
And I'm Erin Gibson, and our show Throwing Shade just moved to Earwolf.
We take a look at women's issues and LGBT issues and make them real stupid.
We make them real dumb. You'll be very insulted by what we have to say. And we have great guests, so come listen to us. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcasting app.
We also talk about clip-on earrings a lot, where to get a great facial.
And wigs.
And a lot of wigs.
It's everything you asked for and nothing you asked for.
All in the same package.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.